History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and then take a little time to patiently listen as memories that may have been hibernating for decades start to emerge once more. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we become inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It is Mother's Day weekend, of course, and we're going to meet one very special mother today who happens to be 104 years old. But for those of us fortunate to still have our mothers with us, what a privilege to celebrate them. I've mentioned before that my mother, Linda, served our country as an Army nurse. But more importantly for me, she has powerfully modeled love for others and a servant's heart. And her example is a big reason I've had the privilege of doing this show for so many years. So thanks to my mom and all the moms out there today. And I did say that number, 104. I'll emphasize it again, 104. Because once you hear Dr. Monica Kinnaman, you are not going to believe she's 104. Thanks to my friend Mark Schaefer with Honor Flight of Southern Colorado for introducing me to this veteran of the British Army in World War II, who has written several dog-related books and also contributed material for the Chicken Soup for the Soul series. A century later, Monica still has clear memories of her childhood in the UK.
I grew up in Yorkshire, north of England. I had a very happy childhood, very secure, very happy. And that all changed, of course, when war broke out. And it's never been the same since.
And you were born, if I'm doing my math correctly, you were born while World War I was still going on. Did you grow up with any of those stories?
Last 6 months of World War I. Yes, I was 6 months old when it ended.
So I'm just curious if as a child, since this is the aftermath of this great war, did you grow up hearing some of the stories of how that had affected families around there?
Yes. Everyone was still talking about the Great War to end all wars, which of course it never did. I heard all the war stories, how my father's brother had got the MC for taking out a machine gun, a pit or whatever it was, single-handedly. And so they're very proud of these brothers that had been in the war and been awarded medals and things. So we heard a lot about it, yeah. Much more than the young people talk about World War II now, probably.
Well, and I imagine the childhood that youngsters experience today is quite a bit different from your childhood. Yes. In the 1920s. What are some of the things you remember about those years? Things you did, or maybe dreams of what you might do someday?
We did things together as a family, which people don't do so much today. We'd go to the sea for a vacation every year, all together. I remember when we were growing up, we would all be together, maybe reading, and we'd all have books, and we'd all be together in one room reading around a big fire. Those were the things that I remember, really.
And most of the vets that I talked to were in America. And in the 1920s in America, the economy changed drastically. And all these people lived through the Great Depression here in the United States. Are there some things that you think back on in your childhood in Great Britain that seem very different compared to today?
Well, of course, in those days, yes, it was quite different for me. For instance, we had servants, you know, like we had a cook and a housemaid and a gardener and all this sort of thing, which, of course, now, so I grew up never learning to cook because they didn't want you in the kitchen. I've never made our own beds or anything like that. And so that all changed. You know, my children don't know that sort of life at all. So, yes, it's quite different.
Hearing you say that, I hope this isn't too bad of a stereotype, but just hearing your description, the first thing that popped into my mind was Mary Poppins.
Maybe we had a Mary Poppins, someone to look after the children, and I don't know, it was all completely different. There was a big difference, of course, between the working people and the ones who had the money in the houses, which, of course, was wrong. One understands that now, that everyone should be the same.
Speaking of the same or similar opportunity, as a young woman in Great Britain, did the future for you look different compared to the future for your brother, for example?
Well, I was not allowed to do things like my brother would do. Women in my day, they pretty much stayed home, sort of taught manners and behavior and so on by your mother, and things like values by your father. They really took an interest in the children and taught them things, which I think often they don't bother to do these days.
And this may be a difficult question to answer on the spot, but hearing you say that, I wonder if you have examples in your mind of something that you feel was important, that was very intentionally imparted to you by your mother or your father.
Well, I think it was very important what they did. My father was very strict, like about honesty and the values that you hope your own children will grow up with. I tried to do the same sort of thing with my own children, teach them and spend a lot of time with them.
Do you remember, as a young lady, having a dream, an ambition of someday, here's who I'm going to become, or here's what I'm going to do with my life?
I don't think so, not particularly. I was sort of like all the young ladies waiting at home for the proper gentleman to come round and sweep you off your feet, and you'd get married and just do the same as your parents did. You know, your mother take care of the children and the father work, and I suppose that's what I expected.
And here in the States, any American veteran, I can ask them about December 7th, 1941, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, and they all remember where they were when the war started for the U.S. But World War II was old hat for those of you in England by that time. So do you have a memory of when all of a sudden you realized what was happening and that your country, your homeland, was under attack?
Well, it began in such a weird way because, you know, there was nothing from 38 to 39, and we were all expecting war to break out, and it really didn't at that time. I think the first time that I really realized that we were at war was standing at a bus stop. Of course, people didn't have gas and things for cars. I'd been in the town waiting for a bus to go home, and a plane suddenly came out of the sky. And I don't know if you know the noise a Stuka makes when it dives. We heard this plane coming, and it dived with that awful sound and dropped its bombs, and I was only about 100 yards away from it, so it bombed a huge hotel, and the second bomb, the 1,000-pounders, I remember all of this very clearly. The second bomb fell in the middle of a road, and the third bomb fell on an unoccupied house. And there were many, many casualties from the hotel, and that, I think, is the first indication of war that I ever remember. Then you realized you really were at war.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. And especially, again, you know, there's such a contrast between the experience in America and the experience in England. Most American civilians were never under attack. They may have feared it on the coastlines, but unless they were in Hawaii or maybe just off the Atlantic coast, nothing ever happened to them. So this has confronted you as a very young woman. Can you help us understand how jarring or fear-inducing, how frightening just that prospect was?
I don't remember being afraid. I remember being very confused because nobody knew what was happening. And some people lay down in ditches, in the gutters, like they'd been taught. Some of them just lay down on the ground. Someone just stared like I did, saw the plane disappearing, which was shot down, incidentally, before it reached the coast. It was more a matter of, you know, what the heck happened, rather than being afraid, because it was over by then, by the time you realized what had happened.
So in that moment, that was very alarming. But I'm curious to know how long it took for that to become almost the expectation or the norm to be under attack like that.
Well, nothing else happened for a while. So we sort of went back almost to normal until war really started, the shooting war.
And how did you see that affecting everyday life in England?
Not at all, really. Everyone just went on doing what they always had done. He just carried on as normal.
And was your brother already in the military?
He joined up as soon as he could, right at the beginning. Yes, see, he was sent first to India, went with Wavell's army over to Europe, and then to the desert.
And you were still at home, I'm assuming, during that time?
No, I was in the army by then.
Well, I want to hear that story about why you joined. But, you know, while I'm on the topic of your brother, how often did you hear from him after he went in?
Well, what happened was we heard from him from India, and saying, don't worry, he's okay. And then we didn't hear for quite a long time. And then a card came from, I don't know if it was the Red Cross, I don't remember now, saying, your son is reported missing, believed killed in action. So nobody knew for a long time that he was still alive.
How hard was that to hear? As someone who'd grown up with his sibling.
Terrible. Terrible, because we'd been such a very close family. My parents prayed, you know, all the time. We all did for him. And my father kept on praying, feeling that he was still alive. And then they got another notice saying that he was a prisoner of war. But before then, all his kit had come back with deceased officer's kit on. So it was a terrible time.
So he was captured in North Africa. Afterwards, was any of that information cleared up? Did you hear some of his story and what he had gone through?
Oh, it's unbelievable, the things that happened to him. In fact, finally, and I think he was in his 80s then, we got him to write a history of what had happened. It's absolutely amazing. He escaped 3 times, and he was taken again 3 times. And what he went through then was amazing.
And I'll come back to that to hear about when you finally got to see him again. I think that would be interesting. But so your brother's in, he ends up as a POW. But what made you decide to join the British Army?
Well, there was war on. Everybody was doing something, really, from, you know, 14, 15 up to 80, 90, whatever. The old people were like Home Guard. There were spotters, you know, for German aircraft. Everyone who could did something, really, with my brother being in the army and my elder sister actually was in the Middle East in espionage. She was in Egypt. Her husband was, I don't know what you'd call him, chief of spies. He was the one who used to send the spies out, so she was involved in that too. My father joined the Home Guard. He was about 65 at that time. He volunteered to be a paratrooper, but of course they wouldn't take him.
And your sister, I mean, as you just told us there, was involved in espionage in the Middle East, an area we don't think a lot about when it comes to World War II. Did she ever share any details about some of the things she had done?
Well, she was not in France or any of those places. I think she did it all, maybe, I don't know, the headquarters. But she knew some of the women who had been put into ovens alive, you know, like the Germans did. She knew some of those. So, yes, that was a bad time.
And so for you, you're a young lady, a college-age young woman, and now you're in the Army. What did that mean? Was there a welcome to the Army moment? Were there any surprises in store for you?
Very, very different. from my upbringing. Yes, very different, because you're in with the roughest and toughest, something I'd never been used to. But it was okay, it was just something that had to be done. I did volunteer for the artillery, because that was the most active part a woman could take at that time, so as in anti-aircraft artillery.
Well, that was going to be one of my questions, because here in the States, the options for women were very limited. What were some of the things women did in the British military during World War II that you're aware of?
I don't know. I think they were something to do with the balloon barrages. They sent up balloons because of the dive bombers. They chauffeured American generals, and I think they had a pretty good time, actually.
But you hear, we need volunteers for the artillery, and you raised your hand.
Well, you were asked what branch you wanted to be in. Did you want to be a clerk or a driver or whatever? And I just volunteered for the anti-aircraft artillery.
Did it occur to you that that could be a dangerous job?
Oh, yeah. Yes, we knew a lot of danger, because by then the bombing had all started.
And can you help us understand that? Because most of us have never lived in a situation where we have to worry about a bomb falling while we're walking down the street, or a buzz bomb stopping and coming down, or any of the things that you endured over there. What did that feel like, to live with that prospect on a daily basis?
The British don't get very excited easily and hysterical or anything like that. I think everyone just took it as a matter of course. Everyone went on with their jobs, and you just carried on the best you could under difficult circumstances.
Did you have to deal with loss, with finding out that people that you knew, that you'd grown up with or you'd worked with or been around, had been killed?
Well, yes, several people were killed before I went into the army. Girlfriends that I'd had who'd married army people. A good friend of mine, her brother, who was only 18, he was killed. He was at an airfield, and I don't know what his job there was, but anyway, they bombed the airfield and he was killed. So I did know a few people.
And you knew that by being in anti-aircraft artillery, your position would be one of the primary targets the Germans would like to take out.
Oh, yeah. They used to go for the gun sights and bomb the gun sights. A good friend of mine was in when they bombed that gun sight, and they were all killed. Nearly all of the gunners were all killed. Yeah.
And I want to ask you about where you were and what your job was, but I'm curious too, because this perspective is so different from what I hear from the American veterans. When you found out that the United States was joining the war as an ally, how significant of a development was that?
That was a tremendous, tremendous thing. I think I was home on leave. And I remember my mother, who was a very calm person, rushing in and grabbing hold of me and saying, "The Americans are coming, the Americans are coming, the Americans are coming," getting so excited, because we knew that was our saving, really. We had come just about to the end of everything. We expected an invasion at any time at all. We were shown how to level the guns to make it into a field artillery instead of anti-aircraft, so that they would be ready if there's an invasion. Yes, everyone was cheering, because we knew that was our one hope of salvation. I can't even tell you how thrilled everyone was that would happen.
And just hearing you say that, I know you told me a moment ago that Brits in general don't get melodramatic or overly emotional. There's that whole keep calm and carry on cliche. But you're a 20-something young lady, and they're telling you the Germans are going to land and invade our island and take over. Isn't that a scary thought?
Well, yes. It was always at the back of your mind that the whole of the German army was 20 miles away across the channel, and we knew that they were getting ready to invade. Yes, that was pretty scary. But, you didn't have much time to dwell on things like that. You're too busy, really, doing what you had to do.
And what we have to do right now is take our first break. But there's much more to come with this remarkable 104-year-old veteran of World War II. You can find photos and a short video with Dr. Monica Kinnaman online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 104-year-old Dr. Monica Kinnaman of Colorado Springs, Colorado. Originally from England, she served in the British Army during World War II.
Well, I had two roles. I was in the ranks for 5 months, and then I don't know how much you know about anti-aircraft, but you had attached to the guns were height finders, range finders, and radar and everything. So I was on one of those instruments that were attached to the guns giving information, and you just worked it with following needles, you know. If you were a height finder, you'd realize how high they were coming in and at what speed they were coming in and so on. Then when I went to OCTU, which is Officer Cadet Training Unit, and became an officer, I was in charge. I just took my turn in charge with the men, because they're all men, plotting the aircraft, you know, because a lot of information came into our command post, all the information. And then it was my job to say fire when they came within range and cease loading when they were out of range. So that was the main thing.
So that brings up a lot more questions in my mind. So thank you for your patience with me as I try to picture this and imagine it. So in that first role, when you're on that rangefinder and you're reading the instrument, where was that? Where were you stationed?
We were stationed between Portsmouth and Southampton, which were our big seaports, which brought troops in, brought all our food in, and only a few of those big ships got through because they were sunk by submarines, which brings back my brother. A submarine almost got their ship going out there. But anyway, Portsmouth and Southampton, our big seaports, we were guarding those. And of course, there are other gun emplacements all around, you know, everywhere.
How long would a shift be? What alert level did you have to be at? Would the Germans only come at certain times of the day? Was this around the clock? What would a shift be like?
Well, it depended, you know. First of all, they didn't come that often, and then as the war progressed, more and more and more, and they're sending thousands of planes over. And at any time, day or night, the night bombers and the day bombers.
So your position would work around the clock?
Oh, yes. Yes, we were 24-hour on duty.
With that anti-aircraft gun unit, and you're calling out the range, helping to inform the gunner who then is trying to shoot down these enemy airplanes. I'm sure there were some successful moments there, right, where you guys were able to shoot down some of those enemy fighters?
Well, you know, everyone says that, but the RAF boys were up there. Also, we had all the different gun emplacements. Everyone was claiming a kill. Almost everyone, so it was very difficult to see. I have seen them shot down in flames, and that's a very sobering sight, because you think of all the guys inside, the young airmen who are just like our own, you know, young. Yeah.
So for the 5 months that you're in that gun crew...
I was in the gun crew, all the time, yes. But I was in the ranks for those 5 months, just as a bombardier, just a corporal.
And were you the only woman there?
Yes, with that lot, yeah. I was nearly almost the only one. I don't know why. There weren't that many women anyway.
Was that a challenge? Or did you enjoy being the only woman? How did you feel about that?
I liked it. I had a great time.
The odds were pretty good? The ratio was good?
Very good. Yes, I never lacked for escorts if we went anywhere. We went up to London occasionally. We went, if you ever got a day off, go up to London, see a show or something. But I regret so much that I just took this, you know, having been a woman, been used to men being the ones, you know, you kowtow to them. About six of us, I think, went up to London. Of course, the others were all guys. We went into a bar, into a pub. The owner or whoever he was, the manager, came out and said, "No women allowed here. This is a men's only bar." And I wish I had said, you know, "You're sitting on your fat ass. We're out there defending you." And I didn't. You know, I wasn't used to doing things like that. Now I would.
And you said you never lacked an escort when there was something happening, but...
We usually went out, you know, a whole bunch of us together.
And how did all those guys treat you?
Just as one of themselves.
And so after 5 months of that, you got to go to officers' training. How did that unfold? What prompted that?
Oh, well, I was recommended by the officers in the batteries that I was in.
So you got that recommendation ahead of a bunch of the men.
Well, I suppose they're sending a whole lot of us to a training. I don't know.
But you must have done something to make an impression on them, or maybe just your consistency. But your performance got their attention.
They were recommending people to be officers, and they picked me as one of them. And I'm sure they were picking others, too.
So what was that like? What did they teach you, or what did that officer's training consist of?
Oh, that was the basics, of course. For the artillery, you had to go to a different school altogether.
Were there other women going through that training?
Yes, yes. Well, but then they transferred you out. You know, once you got officer status, it didn't really work when you had been in the ranks with the others. So, yes, I was transferred out then to the Thames Estuary, and that's where I stayed for the rest of the war.
So how different was it after that, as far as the role that you played? Can you help us understand what was different for you?
Just I was in charge then, instead of being just a regular soldier.
And what about any close calls or memorable moments that you experienced there at that Thames Estuary position?
Well, we had what is called a Z battery in the field next to us. I can't explain the guns they used. They were kind of different. They didn't fire shells or bombs or anything. It was a lot of sort of iron stuff, and it was for low-flying planes, I think. And yes, that was bombed in the field next to us. Another time, a plane, it had taken off. We had an air base pretty near us. They had just taken off to go to France. We heard this chug, 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 and looked, and he was coming down. We could see he was crash landing. He crash landed in the field next to us. So we all ran to try and pull him out before the plane, you know, burst into flames or blew up. When we got there, two land girls had pulled him out. They'd been working in the field, and they pulled him out. He was alive. His plane was all destroyed, but he was still alive. That was one thing. The other, Flying Fortress, that tried to land on our little tiny strip. This huge bomber was coming back from Germany, and he'd been shot up. I think he came in on two engines to begin with, and then he only had one. And he asked permission to land. Do you know what a tow target is? When we went for R&R, it really wasn't R&R. We were working. We were shooting at the target planes just for practice. So our planes landed on a little tiny strip of, because they were very small planes. This was all there was for him to try and land on. Everyone was out, from the commanding officer to all standing on the roofs of Nissen huts and things, holding our breath. And he had to circle three times. Finally, he did land almost at the end of the field, and he crashed through one hedge, across a road, through another hedge. Of course, the firefighters were all there, put the flames out, but none of them were killed. And so everyone was cheering and whooping and hollering. And then they came into our mess for beers and, of course, stayed the night with us. And that was an exciting thing to watch him try to land. He must have been a very good pilot.
I think the next time I hear that song, Coming In on a Wing and a Prayer, I'll probably picture that. Huh?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened, because that, I think he just had one engine by the time he landed.
You know, I'm interested too, and maybe it's no big deal to you because you did it and you lived it. But when you became an officer, and then, as you told us, you're the one giving the command, when to fire. I'm sure you're aware of, you know, how much gravity comes along with those words that you're vocalizing, that there's a life on the other side in your hands, and maybe a lot of your own British lives and Allied lives are in your hands. Did you feel responsibility with that position, to be the one to call those shots, literally?
I don't know. I've never even thought about that. I was concentrating on the plane coming in to bomb us, and following all the information on the equipment round. I don't know. Never even thought about it.
And I guess to try to understand how that worked up here, and you went on to get your doctorate in psychology, so I know you spent a lot of time understanding the brain. Those decisions, when to say fire, when to give that command, was that always black and white and very clear, or were there times where you had to maybe play a hunch?
No, because you were following the information that was coming into your instruments. So you were watching those, and then when it came into the space, then you just said fire. Mm-hmm. And then when it was out of range, it showed that too, and so you yelled, cease loading, and they stopped firing.
And I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you, but you know, you've been in this war and been living with the reality of war since that time you saw the Stuka come in and the bomb lands 100 yards from you. When it got towards the end of the war, and you know that it's getting close to Germany surrendering, were there some things that you saw or heard or experienced that are still clear in your mind today?
Well, yes, we knew the end was coming. Churchill, of course, he was amazing. The way he sort of, the only word I can think of, cheered you all on, saying, we will never surrender. We'll die fighting. We'll never surrender. And that's what everyone expected to do, really. Yes, we knew the end was coming. We had far more hope, you know, after the invasion, that everything was going to be okay.
Do you have some memories around that time of when the Normandy invasion happened, things that you saw in England as that unfolded?
Well, we didn't know, of course, when it happened, because everything was so secret. So we only knew after it had happened. Yes, well, we're all more hopeful. What is the word?
Optimistic?
Yes, that's the word, yeah, that it would soon be over.
And we'll hear about VE Day and beyond when we come back. Dr. Monica Kinnaman of Colorado Springs, Colorado, our guest today, Don't forget to check out photos and a short video with this 104-year-old wonder at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business, and if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. What a journey we have been on today with 104-year-old Monica Kinneman of Colorado Springs, Colorado, a veteran of the British Army during World War II. Her brother Derek was a prisoner of war with a miraculous story of survival. Her sister was an espionage in the Middle East during the war, as she told us. Even her father, deep into his 60s, volunteered for the Home Guard. And as victory in Europe approached, Monica was an artillery officer stationed at the Thames Estuary. The big news of German surrender brought a chance to celebrate with some of the Americans she had gotten to know.
Yeah, we had this large complex of hospitals, which I think I told you my father was liaison officer, and they're only a mile away up on the moors. And so, yes, I was invited up there many times, and my family too, but I particularly being in the services. They invited me up for the celebrations.
Again, I know you've said that you weren't overly emotional, but after all those years of war, to know the war is over, can you help us understand what that felt like, to have that knowledge?
A different person. My brother was a different person. You can't go through all of that and be the same. He and I both were very restless. We couldn't sort of settle to anything for quite a while. I would take off and maybe go to Scotland or somewhere, hitchhike my way through, because there was still a lot of Americans there with their trucks and things. They'd always give you rides. You're a different person. Yeah, I'd never be the same again.
And you mentioned your brother. So when did your family finally know that he was okay and get to see him again?
Well, he didn't come home for 3 years, but after, I think it was about after 6 months, they got the notification that he was alive in a prison camp. It was absolutely amazing what he went through, both good and bad.
And you said, you were different, he was different, the war changed you. What kind of changes did you notice in him?
He was the same, restless. He was just different, not in a bad way, but same as I was, restless and couldn't settle to anything.
And is there something in reading his story, in hearing him talk about it, in understanding what he went through, is there an element of his experience that really strikes you, that you say, boy, I can't imagine dealing with that?
There were so many things that happened to him. He was taken in the desert, as I told you, by Rommel's army. After they were overrun, he walked for 3 days in the desert without food or water. He was half dead when the Black Tent Arabs found him. And they took him back to their tents, and he was with them till he recovered. And then he set off again, trying to reach the British army, which was coming in, I think, at the foot of Italy. They came in at Salerno. He worked his way down by helping farmers and people. He said all the Italian people were so friendly to him and helped him. And he was with one farmer hiding because the Germans were quite near. And he had a pact with the farmer that if the Germans came, that he would go under a water wheel. They had these big water wheels, and he was going to go under the water wheel. And the Germans came, and he didn't have time. They heard there was a British doctor in the area, and they came looking specifically for him. And he didn't have time to get under the water wheel. So, you know, these huge chimneys they had in Italy. He climbed up the chimney inside. He said they ransacked the place, and they were just leaving when one of the Germans came, stuck his bayonet up the chimney, and he had to come down. So, of course, they took him. They blew up the farmer's home, and it didn't kill anyone, which was unusual. And after the war, my brother Derek got a ride in with RAF, one of the RAF planes, on one of the planes. And they took him back. I think they were doing training or something. So they took him back to the farm, the RAF guys, as he walked down the lane to where the farm had been. Here came the old farmer. The British had, they paid him a lot of money. And he'd built a new farm. He was a prosperous farmer by then. And he rushed and embraced Derek. And they were both so happy to see each other. And Derek said, "What can I do for you? What can I give you?" And he said, "I'd like your gold watch," which a patient had given him. So Derek took it off and gave him that, gave him his watch. That was another nice thing that happened. So they had reimbursed him for everything.
Well, and I'm sure he had to endure a lot more in prison camp after the Germans recaptured him.
Oh, yes.
For you, when you think about your time in the Army, is there a part of it that in your memories was the most challenging or the most difficult for you? Maybe the most taxing?
Probably. When I first went in, I went to just basic training in New York. And just being with all these people that I'd never been with those sort of people. Well, now, of course, there's none of that at all. But I just never lived that kind of life. You know, some were rough and swearing and rough and tough, and I'd just never been used to it. So that was pretty hard for me to begin with, to get used to that.
When you think back on it, is there something that you're most proud of with regard to your service that you look back on and say, yeah, you know, I did something significant there?
I don't think so. And people keep saying, oh, you know, it was so wonderful, you did this, did that. I'm no different from anybody else. I never thought of myself as special, and I'm not. I'm just the same as thousands of others, except I came back with my arms and legs and things. Look at Bill, what he went through, and all these people. After they didn't need anti-aircraft anymore, we were broken up, of course, and sent to different regiments. And I went to a sapper regiment, like bomb disposal and so on. And I was with all these guys, maybe with one leg and no arms. And they were the heroes, really, what they went through.
Well, and you just showed me some pictures from just a few years ago here in the States where the British Paralympic volleyball team faced the American Paralympic volleyball team. And some of those are veterans who've lost limbs in war. Yeah. And even Prince Harry was there with those guys, and you got to meet Prince Harry. What was that like?
I was surprised. I thought he'd be much more standoffish, and he was just the same as anybody else, same as we are. And as I say, he just knelt down beside me on the ground, and so that he was at eye level. I was very, very pleasantly surprised, and it did change my view of him. I had rather despised him because of the humiliation he'd brought on the Queen by his antics. You know, he played strip poker in America and things that the royal family had never, ever done. I kind of changed my opinion of him. He was just a regular guy. And that was Harry, you know. That's how he was.
And his grandmother just celebrated a birthday. She just turned 98. But you had a birthday a few months ago, number 104. And yet people are listening to you talk, and your memory is crystal clear, and every thought is coherent. And most people don't live to 104, let alone retain their faculties. So I've got to...
I can remember clearly, you know, growing up and that sort of thing, and things I did during life. But if you ask me what I did 2 days ago, I couldn't remember.
Well, but I have to ask you. I'm not doing my job if I don't ask you. What's your secret? How have you maintained such vitality and mental acuity at age 104?
I had a good answer for that, and I've forgotten what it was now. So my son says, do everything in moderation. And we were brought up on a healthy life. We were encouraged to walk. When I was only a kid, I'd walk 10 miles maybe with my dogs just for enjoyment. I had nothing else to do. I've always tried to stay healthy. I've never been into anything like, you know, heavy drinking or drugs or anything at all. We were brought up all on homegrown food, which I honestly think made a difference. We grew our own vegetables, our own fruit, ate healthy. I don't know. It's not of my choosing, I will tell you. It really wasn't. I think if I died at 95, it would have been a good time. I had my own home. I had three dogs, and we lived. My husband had died, and I think 95 would have been good. I was healthy. I was strong. I was writing books and enjoying myself. I was driving, traveling. And after 100, I really plummeted.
Well, I've met a lot of centenarians, but very few who can tell a story the way you've told today. And I'm glad you didn't call it quits at 95, because then I would have missed out on this privilege. And Mark Schaefer would have missed out here. I just have a couple more questions. And if there's anything I left out that you think is important, please tell me.
This is my home, you know. Mm-hmm. I've been here about 74 years, and this is my home. If I had to choose between America and Britain, I don't know what I would do. I would stay here, of course. But if I didn't have a family here, I don't know. I've thought about that and wondered.
I don't know if this is an easy question or not, because this is a lot to take stock of. But if you reflect back over the 104 plus years you've been on this planet, is there something that you would say you're most thankful for?
Thankful we won the war. I'm most thankful for having a united, wonderful family, both now and growing up.
And so that's the question looking back over 104 years. But I get the sense you've done a lot of looking forward in your life, too. So at age 104, is there something that you're still looking forward to that hasn't happened yet?
No, not at this age. But one thing I will say, America is not the same as when I first came over all those years ago. It has changed. And I know that Britain has changed too, in a way probably wouldn't like it. It may be I would go back and I would hate it, I don't know.
What's the biggest difference that you see?
The dissolution, if one can call it that, of the family, which I think has a great deal to do with America kind of going downhill. I feel we're too far left, going socialist, going possibly communist eventually. Things were much more orderly when I was growing up. You knew where you were, what your place was, what you were supposed to do. Everything was much more orderly. Now anything goes. It's just not the same.
Well, I only have one more thing to say. I need to say thank you. Thank you for your service to the cause in winning World War II, and thank you for telling us a story that nobody else could tell us.
Thank you for listening to me.
What a privilege, what a pleasure, and what a Mother's Day weekend treat to meet Dr. Monica Kinnaman, 104 years young. Don't forget to check out those photos and a short video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. That is all the time we have on the radio today, but thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.